at the beginning of Sesshin, it seems like a long stretch ahead. And now we find ourselves on the last day. This is how impermanence manifests. With this session we've been talking about, bodhicitta, the mind of awakening, the aspiration to drop off body and mind. For the sole purpose of benefiting all beings. The goal of the Bodhisattva path is to free all sentient beings in every realm from all distress and suffering. In whatever way seems most helpful, and the Bodhisattvas contemplating this feel like there are many ways, but maybe the most helpful is to realize complete, perfect awakening. So that's the vow, to realize complete awakening and drop off body and mind, is the means to this end of benefiting all beings. Otherwise, there's no real purpose. And we've been talking about constructing Buddha images and stupas, objects to make offerings to and venerate, and what's going on there? And is this idolatry? So, without getting into some of the extensive discussions we've had about this, just know that Dogen in this fascicle is saying constructing stupas and Buddha images is arousing bodhicitta, the mind of awakening. And he also mentions lots of other kind of like, maybe like traditional, conventional practices in Buddha Dharma, like bowing and offering incense and flowers and light and zazen, all these things that we do in Sesshin, that these simple, ordinary, seemingly fabricated, contrived practices are themselves the mind of awakening. So along these lines, you know, what's the relationship between these practices? We might feel like, what's this have to do with Zen? This isn't why I came to Zen, to offer incense and flowers and bow. And you know, if you're somewhat open to it, this afternoon we're going to have a ceremony where we really get into it. Buddha's parinirvana. You know, we do memorials ceremonies for many teachers and ancestors, but Shakyamuni Buddha is our great original founder. This is his memorial ceremony, so we pull out all the stops and making offerings to images. So, hope you're up for it. So Suzuki Roshi, one of our ancestors, has a section that you, I imagine maybe most people have come across this, but maybe not recently. on bowing, a section called bowing in our primary sutra of our school called Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. After Zazen, we bow to the floor 9 times. And you may have heard that Suzuki Roshi decided to do that practice. The tradition in Japan is you just always do 3 prostrations at the beginning and end of services, except for certain special ceremonies like Buddha's Parinirvana, where there are 9 bows. But he made this a daily thing just because people started saying, why are we bowing to images? And so he said, well, maybe if we bow more, we'll understand. So we bow 9 times. By bowing, we're giving up ourselves. To give up ourselves means to give up our dualistic ideas. So there's no difference between Zazen practice and bowing. Usually to bow means to pay our respects to something which is more worthy of respect than ourselves. But when you bow to Buddha, you should have no idea of Buddha. You just become one with Buddha. You are already Buddha himself or herself. When you become one with Buddha, one with everything that exists, you find the true meaning of being. When you forget all your dualistic ideas, everything becomes your teacher, and everything can be the object of worship. Bowing helps to eliminate our self-centered ideas. This is not so easy. It's difficult to get rid of these ideas, and bowing is a very valuable practice. The result is not the point. It's the effort to improve ourselves that's valuable. There is no end to this practice. And as we know, Suzuki Roshi says elsewhere, you're already perfect and you could use some improvement. And then he says, these bows are in the spirit of the 4 bodhisattva vows. Beings are numberless, I vow to save them, and so on. Although Buddha's way is unsurpassable, we vow to attain it. If it's unattainable, how can we attain it? But we should. That is Buddhism, or Buddha Dharma. To think, because it is possible we will do it, is not Buddha Dharma. Even though it's impossible, we have to do it, because our true nature wants us to. But actually, whether or not it's possible is not the point. If it's our inmost desire to drop away our self-centered ideas, we have to do it. When we make this effort, our inmost desire is appeased and nirvana is there. Or maybe we could say inmost desire is like the aspiration for awakening. Inmost desire, inmost request. And when we make the effort to do these practices, somewhat contrived, any effort is somewhat contrived. But when we make this effort, our inmost desire is appeased and nirvana is there. Before you determine to do it, you have difficulty. But once you start to do it, you have none. Now you started sesshin, you don't have any difficulty, right? Yeah, that's interesting. Before you start to do it, before you determine to do it, you have difficulty, but once you start to do it, you have none. Your effort appeases your inmost desire. Also, after you practiced for a while, you realize that it's not possible to make rapid, extraordinary progress. This is good to remember that this is how it is. It's not just us. It's not just me. Everybody else is making this extraordinary progress, but why am I so slow? Now, after you practice for, at the beginning, when you haven't practiced very long, you maybe think, a lot of people, a lot of my teachers tell that story, right? It's like, I decided to come to Zen Center and I thought I'd practice for a few months, maybe even like a year, and then I'll realize complete enlightenment and then go about my life. And you realize, no, I think this is a lifetime practice or multiple lifetime practice. Even though you try very hard, the progress you make is always little by little. It's like going out in a shower in which you know when you get wet. In a fog, you do not know you're getting wet. But as you keep walking, you get wet little by little. This is a metaphor from Dogen, brings this up to you. Dogen says our practice is like walking in the mist. You get wet very gradually without even noticing that you're getting wet. If your mind has ideas of progress, you may say, oh, this pace is terrible. But actually it's not. When you get wet in a fog, it's very difficult to dry yourself. Is it more difficult than a rainstorm? Maybe, because it permeates through all your layers. A quick rain, you're wet on the outside, you can almost like brush it off and still stay dry inside. So there's no need to worry about progress. This is the Soto way of practice. Just to be sincere and make our full effort in each moment is enough. There's no nirvana outside our practice. So we can do all our practices in this way. So now that we're only halfway through this Dogen fascicle and there's little time to go, so and there's a lot of people here, so before we get into extensive discussions, let's just receive some Dogen for a little while. We'll have time for talking later. So we're at the bottom of page 2, the very bottom. Shakyamuni Buddha said, when the morning star appeared, I simultaneously with all sentient beings and the great earth attained the way, which is the Zen version of Shakyamuni Buddha's enlightenment. He was contemplating the Four Noble Truths and realizing the cessation of suffering and the interdependent arising of the universe. And to top it off, he looked up and saw the morning star. And realized that he attained the way with all sentient beings and the great earth simultaneously. And Buddha realized the way. This is the Zen version. You don't always hear this. When Buddha realized the way, we all realized the way. And you might say, well, I don't know about that, because I don't feel like that. I'm suffering. But we can hear this teaching. Shakyamuni Buddha said, actually, when I realized the way, I realized that you realized the way. Even though you might think that you're suffering. Thus, aspiration, which is hoshin, arousing the mind, generating bodhicitta. Thus, generating bodhicitta, practice, enlightenment, bodhi, and nirvana must be simultaneously aspiration, practice, enlightenment, and nirvana. And in parentheses, with all sentient beings, which was added in by the translators to... And they put in parentheses, I think they could do that a lot to with their interpretation, so I think they do that when they feel like they really like see something in this and they want to make this point. But there are, that's one interpretation. That's what the Buddha actually, the Buddha already has said that. When I realized the way simultaneously with all beings. So Dogen's picking up on this simultaneously. And it seems like, I feel like he's actually, he already made the point, Buddha already made the point that it's simultaneously with all beings. So we almost don't even need to put that in parentheses. But I think he's making the point that these, what look like stages of practice, first you arouse the aspiration to realize the way, you give rise to bodhicitta, the I vow to realize the way for all beings. Then you start to practice. This is kind of like the traditional way of thinking about bodhicitta. Then you realize enlightenment. And then you finally, at the, when your five skandhas are starting to disperse, you enter parinirvana. These are like the stages of the Buddha's life. But Dogen's saying, aspiration, the practice, enlightenment, and the nirvana must be simultaneously aspiration, practice, enlightenment, and nirvana. Yours and all sentient beings. But that this is Zen is the so-called sudden school, right? So this is like the traditional gradual path of stages from arousing the first aspiration to realizing the final fruition. And he's saying these are all simultaneous. That's the Zen way of looking at the first moment of arousing the aspiration is itself the fruition of great enlightenment. And in Hotsu Bodaishin fascicle, Dogen says that. He says the very first aspiration is identical to unsurpassed complete enlightenment. As soon as that aspiration, or, you know, if that aspiration is that all beings realize the way before myself, that's what makes them identical. He says elsewhere, the body and mind of the Buddha way is grass, trees, tiles, and pebbles, as well as wind, rain, water, and fire, which we've already heard that mind is grass and stones, something like this, trees and rocks and pebbles, and all of these things are mind and body. Body and mind of the Buddha way, or from the perspective of the Buddha way, our true body and mind is grass, trees, tiles, pebbles, wind, rain, water, fire. The whole universe is the true human body. To turn them around and make them the Buddha way, this is the aspiration for enlightenment. So our true human body is the inconceivable vastness of everything. And then he says, to take everything, all that grass, tiles, and pebbles, to turn them around and make them the Buddha way, which they already, we just heard they already are, but to turn them around and make them that, this is the aspiration. So though they already are, we can practice turning them around and making them that way, and this is the aspiration. Or, you know, again, it doesn't, you know, this is actually arousing the mind. Literally, it doesn't say aspiration. It says arousing bodhicitta. And to turn them around is, brings to mind what we were talking about, echo hensho, turning the light of awareness around, shining it back on the source of all thought. And that is realizing the vast, empty luminosity of Buddha nature and dropping off body and mind, where all beings simultaneously realize the way. So, therefore, we could say, we can look out at the vast world of grass, tiles, pebbles, rocks, trees, and take and that whole world out there, turn it around, back to the source, and make them the Buddha way. See how they're not outside this mind. Trace back the radiance that we call grass, tiles, and pebbles to the source of thought, thinking of what doesn't think. That thinking of what doesn't think makes grass, tiles, and pebbles into the Buddha way, which it already is. And this is arousing bodhicitta. Take up empty space to build a stupa and create a Buddha image. This is how we actually, how do we create clay, wood, metal, or painted Buddha images, and clay, metal, wood, or painted stupas. We take up empty space. We build them from empty space. That's how we make everything. Scoop up valley water to build a stupa and create a Buddha image. So, same. The pure valley stream, that clear, tasteless water we construct the world from. Another translation actually says, swallow valley water to build a stupa, create a Buddha image. It's, I think, same, but just a different quality. A little more intimate, maybe, than scooping it up. This is arousing, again, for those who are just arriving. Every time it says aspiration, at the aspiration for enlightenment, that's just the way of translating bodhicitta in this essay. So, and I think it translated that way maybe points in directions that aren't quite as open as what Dobin's pointing to, I propose. So if we just say bodhicitta or the mind of awakening, bodhicitta, the mind of awakening, means two things traditionally. It means both the aspiration to realize the way for all beings. That's called a relative bodhicitta. And it means the mind of awakening. It means the awakened mind. That's the kind of like fruition of that aspiration. That's the ultimate bodhicitta. And since it means both, I think Dogen's playing with both. So I would, you know, instead of always talking about it as an aspiration, literally what it says is this, instead of this is arousing the aspiration for unsurpassable, it's really this is arousing unsurpassable complete enlightenment. Anuttara samyak sambodhi. This is arousing, I think this is how I could translate this next sentence. This is arousing the mind of awakening, bodhicitta. 100 times, 1,000 times, myriad times. This is practice and realization. Shusho, one of Dogen's favorite terms. Practice and realization are not two. Practice dash realization. This being so, those who think that arousing the mind only happens once, although practice for attaining one realization happens innumerable times, have not heard, known, or encountered Buddha Dharma. So there is a kind of like, you know, that in the Mahayana tradition, there's a teaching that you, bodhicitta, this aspiration, in a kind of genuine, uncontrived way, is born at a particular moment, and you actually, it's a major, like, milestone kind of thing. It's even called a change of lineage. You actually, like, are born as a bodhisattva at the moment this first aspiration, the selfless wish to, like, actually, I see the problem here in this universe. There's a lot of suffering. I see the origin of suffering is grasping, and all beings, including me, are totally caught up in this. Is there any way out? Yeah, I think there is. It's to help all beings realize the complete end of grasping, called complete perfect enlightenment. That's the freedom from suffering. And in order to help them do that, I'm going to work on that too. And whether or not I go first or they go first is a matter of question that I'll probably talk about with my Dharma friends in sesshins and things like that. Whether we go all together or they go first or I go first. But it looks like everybody has to realize awakening, which just means the end of suffering. And when this wish is born for once, then we become this bodhisattva. And then traditionally it's like, you don't have to keep wishing it again. It's like when it's really genuinely born, it's like it can never be lost. I mean, that's one way of talking about it. It's like now you're a bodhisattva and you get in the car and you start go driving down the paramita road and practicing, and almost like it's irreversible. This one is one tradition in teaching. You can't forget. Once you're driving like that, it's so clear where you're going that you can't turn back. So you only arouse bodhicitta once. You maybe have to nurture it again and again. But this is in Zen way, it's like nothing's only once. Because practice and realization are never separated. It's not like you do that practice of arousing bodhicitta once and then you're done with that. It doesn't make sense. You have to keep, in order for the realization that's united with that practice to be united with practice, you have to keep practicing arousing bodhicitta. So this non-duality of practice and realization, I think, is where Dogen's coming from when he says, if you think that you only arouse the aspiration once and then you have to practice again and again but not arouse the aspiration, he says that's not the way. We have to actually, I think aspiration does fit in this case, I think is what he is talking about. Arousing the aspiration for enlightenment 1,000 times, 1 billion times is no other than arousing the aspiration for enlightenment one time. So there really in non-duality, there really is only one time called right now. But right now we arouse it. And right now we arouse it. It's always right now, but we keep arousing it right now. A billion times, one time, which is one time right now. Arousing the aspiration for enlightenment by 1,000 billion people is not other than arousing one aspiration. Or you could say, not other than one person's arousing it. As we just chanted, awakening Bodhi mind, which is bodhicitta, we are one Bodhi mind. So if we arouse it, this aspiration once, all beings arouse it simultaneously with the great earth and all beings. Arousing the aspiration for enlightenment one time is arousing the aspiration for enlightenment 1,000 times, 1 billion times. Practice, realization, and the turning of the Dharma are also like this. Again, you could say these almost like stages. In this case, practice, realization, and turning the Dharma wheel. If you are not grass and trees, how can you have body and mind? But so there's, as often the case, there's actually no pronouns in here. In Chinese and Japanese, sometimes there are, but this is open. So other translations say, if they are not grass and trees, how can they have body and mind? And then some other translators say, what they is being referred to here? And one possibility is practice and realization. So one way to hear this is, if practice and realization are not grass and trees, how can practice and realization have body and mind? This is how it's difficult to read Dogen. If you are not, or they are not, body and mind, how can you or they be grass and trees? It is so because you cannot be grass and trees without being grass and trees. Okay. Zazen, the endeavor of the way. Zazen Bendo. Sometimes we translate it as the wholehearted way. The wholehearted way of Zazen is arousing bodhicitta. Is Hotsu Bodaishin. Zazen Bendo is Hotsu Bodaishin. Wholehearted practice of Zazen is arousing the mind of awakening. Probably not such a surprise that Dogen would say that. Arousing bodhicitta is neither one nor many. Another way to translate it is, arousing bodhicitta is neither one nor different from Zazen. Zazen is neither one nor many, neither two nor three. Well, we could think of this as, you know, all when we're practicing Zazen, all our different Zazens are not one Zazen or many Zazens. They don't fall into either of those extremes. The relationship between all our Zazen when we're practicing is beyond one or many, and beyond two and three, neither two nor three. We could also hear it as like sequential periods of Zazen, like Sashin. It's like, how many periods of Zazen are there in Sashin? Two, three, four. It's like, what, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 periods a day times 5 days is 40 periods of Zazen. And we sit them all. And, but it's not like that. Zazen, there's not really 40 periods of Zazen in Sashin. There's just one period. We're in it. And actually, when the final ceremony ends and we go home, we're still in it. This is a long period of Zazen. But actually, it's not long at all. It's just one moment. It's not long or short. It's not one or many. That's how Zazen is. Thoroughly... Oh, it's not the same either. Or another translation, it's not an arrangement. This is maybe any way that our mind would arrange what Zazen is. Thoroughly investigate each and every Zazen in this way. So one of Dogen's favorite terms again is thoroughly investigate Sangkyu, and which sometimes other traditions might criticize Soto Zen is like, it's just sitting there and you're not doing anything. How you, you know, there's no investigation and, you know, understanding and insight and realization because you're just not using your mind at all. So there's that side of things, but Dogen's always saying, thoroughly investigate. And he's writing a lot of things for us to investigate. If the process of assembling grass, trees, and the seven treasures to build a stupa and create a Buddha image were a purposeful activity, or as we've been talked about this before, a fabricated activity or a constructed compounded conditioned activity, So if the process of doing this very like ordinary activity of collecting a bunch of grass and trees and seven treasures to build a stupa and create a Buddha image, if that were a fabricated activity and not attaining the way, because there's a teaching that truly realizing the Buddha way is unfabricated and uncompounded, then the 37 wings of enlightenment would also be purposeful or fabricated activity. You know, 37 wings of enlightenment is one of these old traditional lists. Dogen has a whole fascicle called 37 Wings of Enlightenment, but it's pre-Mahayana. It's in the Pali Suttas too. And it's just like, basically it's like all, it's a whole list of practices, each of sets of practices, and each one of them is in a way like a complete set in itself, but it's a nice thing to kind of like look at sometimes to see like, oh, am I including all 37 wings in my practice? So it's like, I don't know if I can remember them all, but it's like the four foundations of mindfulness. You can add up these numbers and see if you get to, if they get to 37. The four right efforts, which are like abandoning unwholesome and preventing the unwholesome and encouraging the wholesome and maintaining the wholesome, and it's like five powers, five fully developed powers, four kind of something else, seven factors of enlightenment is a nice list in itself, and the Eightfold Noble Path.
40. That's 32.
Four plus five plus five. And plus seven plus eight. How much is that? 32? So then there's another five powers. Five like bases of supernatural power or something like that. There's some kind of obscure lists in here. Anyway, you can find them all over this dreamlike world in which Buddha Dharma pervades everywhere. 37 wings of enlightenment are. Pervade our realm. In the English language. Anyway, it's like all these practices, like kind of, I think you could say they're all kind of inner meditative practices. So, which people don't have a problem with. They say that's like uncontrived true practice. But like gathering grass, trees, and jewels and things like this to build stupas and create Buddha images, that's not like the 37 wings of enlightenment, right? That's just some like mundane, fabricated activity. So Dogen's saying, if collecting these grass and trees is fabricated activity, then the 37 wings of enlightenment would also be fabricated activity. Endeavoring in the practice with the bodies and minds of humans and devas of the three realms would also be fabricated activity and would not enable you to arrive at the ultimate ground of enlightenment. Well, I think it's a nice like argument that Dogen's making is really about like the two truths. If we're talking from the perspective of conventional truth, then 37 wings of enlightenment, like the Noble Eightfold Path, right view, right conduct, right thought, all of these things are actually conventional practices, and so is gathering up a bunch of like wood and clay and carving, making a stupa. They're both conventional practices, and in their true nature, they're both totally unfabricated, uncontrived, empty activity. also. So he's pointing out, people like to make distinctions and say this is true practice and this is not. I think is his point. Like I mentioned the other day, in my Hinayana phase, I sometimes would, like at Tassajara, I'd sometimes say to the people creating the sesshin schedules, like, why do we have to have a work period in sesshin? Because that's like fabricated activity. We should just sit zazen the whole time. Dogen, in an earlier part of this essay, said, foolish people of the Hinayana, small vehicle, think like that. I've thought like that. But right now, I love this work period. I use it to activate my like conceptual mind, and like it's starting to like ooze stuff out my ears, and like it's when I'm like always a couple minutes late to zazen because I can't stop conceptualizing, and like I gotta like talk about this stuff again. Really, I go like straight to the room and start like thinking and thinking and thinking. It's totally fabricated activity. And it's so purposeful and contrived. You're actually probably, if you're working in the garden or something, your practice is probably much closer to zazen than mine at that time. But I love it. Getting totally like my brain getting like overheated. I love it so that I can go back into the zendo and cool off.
That's totally the pretty experience that I have.
Yeah, well, we might say we did talk about this when it came up earlier, that some people actually find the flow and, you know, being really one with their activity easier when they're actually active. Many people, I think, find this. And when they come to the zendo, that's when they're just sitting there, it's so boring that their minds start like really churning up all this stuff. But as soon as they start like weeding the garden, they're just like not even thinking. So, you know, it's not really about what we're doing or not, but I think it's just talking about people can have either one of these views, that this one is the real practice and this one's not. Then we might say, well, zazen's not a real practice, that's just a time to go obsess about your stuff. That's why I'm just working the garden. That would also be the same view, right? It's like garden works, true unfabricated activity. And zazen, what a joke. So both of them are equally, you know, fabricated in a way, and the true nature of all fabricated things is vast emptiness. Endeavoring in the practice with the bodies and minds of humans and devas of the three realms would also be purposeful, fabricated, and would not. And therefore, Dogen is kind of agreeing, if it's just merely purposeful, fabricated activity, then how can we arrive at the ultimate ground of enlightenment? It's just that all fabricated activities have an ultimate ground of enlightenment. But if they were just merely fabricated, then we would never be able to be free.
But so there's both. You're building a house.
Both.
And you're putting your spirit into it. You're making it a practice. And then you live in it. It's just a practice. Got a roof over
you. Yeah, and you're living in it can also have both sides. Everything is always, the two truths are never separable. The conventional and ultimate. Because appearing things only appear due to causes and conditions. That's their conventional truth. Then they don't inherently exist in some like unconditioned way, which means they're empty of existing in and of themselves. They only arise dependent on conditions, which means they're empty of independent existence. So that's why the two truths can't be separated. Someone had a footnote going with this section here, and I don't know if it's directly related, but it's related, I think, somewhat to these two truths. They quoted Nagarjuna, who says, if everything is empty... Oh, somebody asks Nagarjuna, if everything is empty, then there can't be any path or enlightenment. This was somebody misunderstanding emptiness as like a nothingness. If everything were empty, as I think of it, as like just nothing, then there's no path and no enlightenment or anything. And Nagarjuna responds, if everything were not empty, then there could be no path or enlightenment or anything. Because if everything were not empty, means like it inherently, independently existed, then everything would be suddenly frozen. You couldn't move. There'd be no, well, it's impossible. But then there could be no, nothing could evolve or ever change if things were not empty. Grass, trees, tiles, and pebbles, as well as the four great elements and the five skandhas, four great elements, earth, water, fire, air, and five, is the kind of like the old Buddha way of talking about the so-called physical world is actually just these four elements, and the mind world is these five skandhas. Really, four form skandha is these four elements, and feelings, perceptions, formations, consciousness are mind, and there's nothing other than four elements and five skandhas. It's like that's the whole universe. So grass, trees, tiles, pebbles, as well as the whole universe of four elements and five skandhas are all equally... It says inseparable mind, but it literally says mind only in the characters that are used to translate, like chittamatra. It's funny, the inseparable mind... I don't know why they would translate it quite like that. Only inseparable from mind, maybe. It'd be like mind only. Only mind. Equally marks of reality. The entire world of the ten directions, Buddha nature of thusness, is equally things abiding in their conditions. So this is just, Dogen just sort of summarizing in all different ways how things are. Grass, trees, walls, and pebbles, the whole universe of the elements and the skandhas are all mind only, and they're equally the true marks of reality. And the entire world of the ten directions, the Buddha nature of suchness or thusness, is equally dharmas abiding in their dharma position, is literally what it says, which we've talked about here before. It's an important part of the Genjo Koan, things abiding in their dharma position. Our translation says the phenomenal expression, which Dogen actually Dogen uses it quite a bit different places, and it comes from the Lotus Sutra, this idea, but dharmas abiding in their dharma position are in the Gendra Koan, Dogen says, they're fully independent of past and future. They just abide in their dharma position, independent of past and future, and they're fully dependent on past and future causes and conditions. So it's just another way of talking about how things are. They're completely interdependent. Of course, everything is completely interdependent with everything. That's the main teaching, but then there's this little twist with abiding in their dharma position means they, there's a sense in which they're just abiding here and now, independent. We say independent, that contradicts like Nagarjuna and so on, but not really independent. It just means this flashing of this moment right now, that where we're not talking, we're not looking into past and future. The total presence of this moment is in a way experientially independent. That's what we mean by independent in the Genjo Koan. At the same time, completely interdependent. That's dharmas abiding in their dharma position, or things abiding in their conditions. How can there be trees, grass, and so on within the Buddha nature of thusness? So Dogen's asking, since the Buddha nature of suchness is empty of all reference points, how can there be grass, trees, and so on within the Buddha nature of suchness? How can grass, trees, and so on not be the Buddha nature? So it doesn't fall into either side. Buddha nature doesn't have anything in it, and everything is in Buddha nature. There's not really anything in Buddha nature, but everything manifests from and as Buddha nature. So Dogen's asking these rhetorical questions to himself or to us. All things are neither created nor not created, but are reality. Reality is reality as it is. Reality is the reality of suchness. So this is the middle way, again and again. It's not created, it's not uncreated. It's not that there's things in Buddha nature, it's not that there's no things in Buddha nature. Lustness is the body and mind right now. Arouse the aspiration with this body and mind. Do not avoid stepping on water and stepping on stones, or walking on water and walking on stones. And I take that to be like, don't avoid the conventional world, the conventional truth. He's talking about all this kind of ultimate Buddha nature of suchness, and then suchness, which is, you know, a synonym of emptiness, where there are no things. Suchness is body and mind right now. Arouse the aspiration for realizing suchness with this conventional body and mind right now. Do not avoid walking on water and walking on stones. I don't think that we have to like disappear as a person to do this. But you could say, what about walking on water? And one commentary says, you know, don't avoid walking on stones is really don't avoid the ordinary activity of walking through the world. And don't avoid walking on water is, you could say, maybe even don't avoid kind of miraculous activity, which is still just conventional. You know, there are miraculous powers like walking on water and walking through walls, but that's not the ultimate truth, right? That's just magic. We've been talking about magic some. I think that, magical events are actually still just conventional truth. It's just that we don't understand exactly what it is.
What's not magic about walking?
And then in the ultimate truth, actually, I would say there is no magic and no non-magic. There's no concepts like that in the ultimate truth. So magic is a conventional truth, but it's an unusual conventional truth. And we don't avoid it. And we also don't avoid walking on stones. To take up just one blade of grass and create a 16-foot golden body of a Buddha, or to take up a particle of dust and build a stupa shrine of an ancient Buddha, is arousing the aspiration for enlightenment. It is to see Buddha and hear Buddha. It's to see Dharma and hear Dharma. It is to become Buddha and practice Buddha, or to make a Buddha and practice Buddha. This is just general Dogen celebrating the inconceivable reality in his usual way. So let's go on a little bit, because this next little section might be a little bit controversial. You might get some interesting discussion mileage out of this one. Shakyamuni Buddha said, laymen, laywomen, good men and good women, or men and women of good family, it's a traditional way of talking, make an offering of their spouses and children to the three treasures of Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. They make an offering of themselves to the three treasures. And literally it says in there, themselves. Maybe Kaz couldn't quite stand to even maybe write this, but it literally says, they make an offering of the flesh of their own body to the three treasures. All monks receive such faithful offerings. How can you, monks, not practice diligently? So it's strange. I don't know what sutra this comes from. But I've just been contemplating. This is kind of strange. I never heard about lay people offering their spouses and children to the three treasures. I mean, like, literally? I mean, some people do, actually. In the Asian world, do give, like, their children to the monastery. So maybe it is referring to that in kind of a literal way.
Don't you think he's just, you know, browbeating his monks? You know, hey, look how much people are doing.
I think that is the point.
Step it up here.
Yeah. I think that is. He's admonishing the monks that, like, you're receiving the most precious offerings, the greatest, the hardest thing to give up for lay people is their spouses and children, maybe. And people give everything of themselves to the three treasures for you, monks. And, you know, I mean, again, this is kind of Asian Buddhism. Is the temples are supported by the lay people, and the monks just have to practice. And so if they're... And it's hard to tell what practice is, right? It's easy to tell what giving away your spouse is. Or, you know, making a huge offering to the temple. It's very tangible. But practice is not. So monks could be like, well, I'm here and receiving all these offerings, but I don't really know what practice is anyway, and I'm glad to be supported here. This is maybe a problem in Asian Buddhism, is people do sometimes go to the monastery because especially very poor people, because they're supported. It's a life. And you have to follow certain rules and stuff, so you can't just do anything, but you might not be practicing that sincerely. You're getting a free ride kind of thing. So I think that is the spirit of Buddha saying this, but I just thought, offering their spouses and children? I think, well, could that be? And then I thought, well, in a way, I'm sort of like personally confronting this issue of, I kind of feel like I'm giving my spouse to the three treasures. Because she's in this Buddhist studies program in Nepal, right, for 3 years, and she only gets to come back in the summer for a few months. And it's kind of hard for our relationship. And I remember when she was first contemplating it, she really wanted to study Buddha Dharma and deepen her practice. And it was coming from bodhicitta. I really feel like here's her sincere aspiration to deepen practice and explore that path, Tibetan Buddhism. And so like, who am I to say like, well, and she found that program. So we talked and we're like, well, maybe there's something closer. That's like, I think, you know, if the globe is like this, they're like almost exactly opposite sides. It's as far as you can get. Even the East Coast of America would be a lot closer. Even Europe. But there were various conditions. And this was a really great program. He looked into other stuff, but like this one seems to be like the one to do. And I remember feeling like some resistance and at the same time feeling like, this is like bodhicitta. You want to stop this because your attachment of being with her? And she felt the same too, right? And so she kind of gave up her spouse for the three treasures, to the three treasures too. Temporarily.
For 2 years.
sometimes if I start to feel like, oh, well, actually it's kind of hard and maybe our whole relationship will fall apart because of it, I still feel good about it. And in order to keep our relationship together, we try to talk all the time on Skype, right? And then almost every day we talk on Skype, except for Sesshin. And you know, if we were both in Sesshin in our respective places, which I think has happened before, maybe a couple of times, like she is on a retreat there, then it's quite easy. But if we have one person's on the retreat and the other one's just not, just in their daily grind, and it's kind of hard, you know, for her studies and stuff, it's very dry. just to have that emotional connection. It's kind of hard. It's been hard sometimes when I say, I really like, there's not really time in Sesshin, and we have this guideline of like, let's try not to talk. And I'm like, as I say, I go right to my room and I have to like immerse my brain in this stuff. So like, oh, please, can you give me to the three treasures for this week? And sometimes it's hard. And for both of us, it's like, we can feel this a little bit of, a little or a lot, attachment sometimes. And then really the spirit of like, but this is really for practice. We really want to support the other's practice. I mean, our relationship, when we got together, she's another priest. And we're like, this is, our life is practice. And so if we're going to get together, let's put the practice first. And that will actually support our relationship. If we don't, if we put the relationship above the practice, actually, it probably won't support. It won't work as a relationship. Just because of the kind of people that we are, I think it's true. Because I've been in other relationships where sometimes the relationship started to, from one side or the other, started to become more important than the practice, and then they didn't work out. It's quite interesting. I think if one person's a practitioner and one's not, then it's a little tricky. And I don't know how, then it's hard, you have to work that out in different ways. But, you know, we were both, you know, practicing with vows of celibacy actually for some years before we got together. And so we're like, okay, let's get together because we want to explore relationship as practice, but let's not forget that that's what we're doing. And of course, we're like totally attached. We're totally attached. And it's painful to be attached. Sometimes then we get opportunities to give our spouses to the three treasures. Dogen says, thus know that lay people offer food and drink, clothes, bedding, medicine, monks, huts, fields, and forests to the three treasures. is no other than offering the flesh, skin, bones, and marrow of themselves, their spouses, or their children. So Dogen's kind of playing with, the original actually says, offer their own, the flesh of their own body to the three treasures, and then he has this Zen phrase from Bodhidharma about skin, flesh, bones, and marrow. By doing so, they are already in the meritorious ocean of the three treasures. They are in one community. But really, maybe more accurately, they are of one taste. I guess this character can mean something like community or taste. They are of one taste. Which is a kind of a classic Dharma phrase of like, realize the one taste of all things, the one flavor of all things, which is suchness. As they are one taste, they are with the three treasures, but I think literally it says, as they are one community or one taste, they are the three treasures. The virtue of the three treasures is actualized, genjo, in the skin, flesh, bones, and marrow of their spouses and children, or of their own bodies and the bodies of their spouses and children. This is diligent endeavor of the way. Bendo Kufu. Kufu is Japanese for Kung Fu, the Dogen sometimes, which uses this word that means like, Kung Fu actually means like diligent, effortful activity. Right now, take up the essence and form, or the nature and marks of the world-honored one, and grasp or study, and study the skin, flesh, bones, and marrow of the Buddha way. This faithful offering is arousing the aspiration. How can monks who receive such an offering not diligently practice from beginning to end? So this is a section of arousing bodhicitta by offering what's hardest to offer, offering everything. But again, it's not really emphasizing compassion. You know, is this offering to all beings? It's more like offering to the three treasures. So I think we could say maybe part of bodhicitta, arising bodhicitta, is in addition to great compassion, is renunciation, or like letting go of what's hard to let go of for the sake of Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. Sometimes giving away the flesh of our own bodies is like putting them on a seat for 40 periods of zazen. Giving away the flesh of our butt, the comfortable flesh, letting it be uncomfortable. It's making an offering of our body. Literally, sesshin really is making an offering of our body to the three treasures, is it not? So why don't we stop here and see anything's arising to talk about. Yes.
Question. At what point did you, or what made you give up your Hinayana inclination and embrace the Mahayana?
Yeah.
What causes and conditions
for that? Yeah, it's a great question. Because I think, and we talked about them, I think on the first day of sesshin, we talked about these three motivations for practice of one traditional thing I think is interesting to check out for ourselves. One motivation, and I think you could maybe say, and maybe any spiritual practice, one is like, but I think particularly Buddha Dharma is so much about relieving suffering, and they're kind of worded like this. So the first is practicing it for the temporary and immediate relief of our own suffering. I'm having a really hard time right now, so I'm going to sit zazen right now to like calm down, and that's enough. Mindfulness-based stress reduction. could be seen as like a temporary relief of suffering. And then the second motivation is like more like ongoing and complete realization of the end of suffering, like nirvana, that doesn't depend on conditions like sitting down for this period. It's just, I know if I sit quietly, I'll relax, but I actually want to realize nirvana, that's like the unconditioned freedom that through this realization, and it's an everlasting, irreversible freedom for myself. That's the second, motivation. So both of those are so-called Hinayana.
Yeah.
And then the third motivation is practicing for the end of suffering of all sentient beings throughout space and time. And that's the Mahayana. So there's two Hinayana and one Mahayana. And I think that maybe we all go through all various versions. Even maybe we go through that three-part progression in practice, or maybe we don't. But I think for me, I think I did kind of go through all three. First, I told the story, I was just really suffering and in the moment, and I'm like, I gotta do something because my mind's insane and I gotta really focus on practice.
That was second. First, you just thought it was kind of cool and
good. Yeah, there's that too. But I think when I really turned more seriously to it, it was to relieve this suffering right now. And it wasn't, and I didn't care so much about nirvana. I'm just like, I'm just really upset and I need to settle. And then I started hearing more and more about the unconditioned freedom of nirvana. Even though I might not have understood it, I thought, this is amazing. And the more I studied, the more it actually did make sense that, oh, this seems like, I understand this is a possibility. It's not just an abstract thing. Because of how the conceptual mind creates suffering. And if the conceptual mind isn't doing that, there really could be this ongoing freedom. And then I got really into it, and I got really into even like Theravada Buddhism, which again is not the Hinayana, but I like all these kind of practices and techniques that I could use for myself to find this freedom, and great inspiration from these forest yogis that would go off and practice like that. And although I read Mahayana sutras and heard Mahayana teachings and Bodhisattva teachings about all beings, and I always appreciated them, I think in my heart I really like thought, well, that's nice, but like I'm drawn more to this, I just gotta get free here in my heart. And I still sometimes have those tendencies, right? But I feel like the more and more practicing this Mahayana thing is blossoming more and more. And what are the conditions for that? I think a big part of it is my teachers, Tenzin Roshi in particular, and I even feel like his own practice is evolving in this way from, over the 20 years of practicing with him, the kinds of things he was teaching. Anyway, these days he's like really into this Bodhisattva, Bodhicitta thing, and because of my connection with him, I have a strong intimate connection, practice connection. Maybe 25 years now, something, about 25. And I think because of that, he has this great influence. So if something's changing like that in him, it starts, I mean, he had that more, and sometimes he would point these things out to me, and I would internally resist them a little bit, like, well, yeah, sounds good, but like, and I've also gotten more into Tibetan teachings, and they've really emphasized this bodhicitta compassion side. And so the teachers that also have the teachings, but particularly living teachers that have a strong connection, I feel that coming from them, and I feel inspired by their teaching about it. And so hard to say there's any one condition to shift. I don't think it's like one particular moment.
No, but I mean, like, when you said it before this, I was pretty much Hinayana, and that was
something that Maybe in the last, 7 or so years. And also, maybe another part of it too, is being more in this role of teaching.
Yes.
I think is, because that was about that time, about 7 years, where, instead of like, I'm just going to try, like, as much as possible, sort of escape these like difficult people into my little cave and do my practice. It's more like, no, you're not going to. and then talking, and then Doka-san for me is like, sometimes people say, I sure you have time, I don't want to bother you, and I feel like it's a great joy for me to talk with people about practice. It's not a burden. And to hear people's difficulties, which often what you hear in Doka-san, is arouses compassion, right? It's like, oh yeah, and sometimes I can relate to that too. I thought I was the only one with that problem. So I think some of it. And then, maybe just to add in some inconceivable to it. I would say like this, we've been talking about generating merit, this sesshin too, and like if this compassionate wish is not arising, or anything in one's practice that one's trying to bring forth and doesn't feel like, as I mentioned, teachers will often say, you just gotta accumulate. We have a problem, maybe we don't like this word, but generate more merit, which is just virtuous activity. And merit is actually that the well-being and happiness that's the result of wholesome activity. So there may be something like I didn't have enough merit to open to the Mahayana. It took many years of gathering merit very, very slowly to start opening more and more to the profundity of the Mahayana. Maybe. Yeah.
Just opened it up for discussion. And I was thinking of that first passage from Zen Line, the Giver's Line.
Yeah.
Bowing. And it's difficult before you start, but then you start. And I'm wondering, that's actually kind of my literal experience of bowing in the morning, usually the first bow of the artist.
Physically or like?
Yeah, physically. And I really appreciate bowing as a practice. So on a conscious level, it's not, maybe on an unconscious level, I'm not aware of resistance. But I think maybe part of what he's alluding to is if we step out of the way enough to let ourselves be kind of made by the activity,
or put aside
the conscious mind, then we're living in a different kind of way.
Yeah.
Where we're not trying to do things, but we just let go and let life kind of keep going with a little bit less overlay.
Yeah, the myriad things coming forth and realizing themselves or realizing yourself, as opposed to carrying ourselves forward and bowing. We let the myriad circumstances of the room give us the bow. Yeah. And we've talked about on an earlier day, an interesting question for me that I would like to keep exploring is, what is the most, the attitude that's most in accord with these practices like bowing or incense offering? Because on the one hand, we can say, we don't want to get all conceptual about it, like, okay, Buddha's over there, I'm over here, I think this would be good like this. That seems a little too fabricated and contrived. And then the other extreme would be like, just do it as like almost like mindfulness of body. Just do the activity without any mind at all. And sometimes we might, in Zen, we might almost promote that side. It sounds pretty good, but I wonder about that, because then the heart of the almost like the maybe even emotion behind it is maybe there. It could get too dry. It could be like we're just mechanically doing a physical activity. But then if we start to bring in some spirit or mind, then it can almost instantly turns into some conceptual thing. So I wonder if there's some middle way that's not quite like a dualistic contrivance. It's just bowing, but there's some feeling behind it. And maybe with certain activities like bowing, maybe there naturally is a feeling with no conceptuality. We maybe do have that with bowing, yeah? Sometimes I feel that. It's not just physical, and yet I'm often not thinking about it either, but there's, especially this little part, right, of like lifting, we say we lift Buddha's feet above like that, and I like to just hold it for a second and let Buddha kind of like raise Buddha, let him walk across there, and without thinking that thought, but these universal gestures gestures that are like maybe have evolved to express something really directly that doesn't take much conceptuality, but it creates a certain kind of feeling in everyone.
Couple words like appreciation, gratitude, grace.
Yes, gratitude. Can we bow with a feeling of gratitude without any idea about what we're doing? Maybe so. And maybe sometimes it comes from having thought about it before. What is bowing about anyway? Oh yeah, it's expressed, I'm going to do it to express gratitude. And then we think about it, it's kind of conceptual for a while, and then we start, the feeling of gratitude maybe gets associated with the activity, and then we can stop thinking about it. Maybe that's a way that that middle way could work. Because he's saying just do it, and then you're one with Buddha. Or what is it? He says, to give up ourselves. When you bow to Buddha, you should have no idea of Buddha. You just become one with Buddha. Then you are Buddha. You forget all your dualistic ideas. So that's kind of like just doing it. But then later he says, my teacher had a callus on his forehead from bowing. He knew he was an obstinate, stubborn fellow. And so he bowed and bowed and bowed. The reason he bowed was that inside himself, he always heard his master's scolding voice. So that's like quite different from what he originally said, right? It's like there's no reason even, and you just do this, forget all your ideas. It sounds like he said, my teacher actually felt like he was a stubborn person and he was going to do this activity to practice humility, which is one of the traditional purposes of bowing, to lower our self before the great Buddha. Yeah.
Bowing until you have callus on your head sounds unbalanced. Because there's a functional balance, I think, that is inherent in life that has you doing more than just bowing or even just aspiring. It has you living a life. It might have children. It might have thing that you love to do.
Yeah, it could be anything. But, you know, his teacher was a Zen priest, so he had a lot of time for bowing.
How does that happen? What allows first the Zen priest to exist? Which
many causes and conditions.
In what natural order do we have a sect who is set aside to just bow and the rest of the people have to go about plowing the fields?
Well, if they're saying, I mean, that's part of the controversial thing about Dogen saying, if the people are working really hard, and I think this is where I thought the conversation might get kind of juicy, right? If the people are plowing the fields are like are like, they're doing the real work so that this guy has the leisure to get a callus on his forehead. It's so easy to get a callus on your forehead. But actually the people plowing might have calluses in their hands, but they might not, right? They might be just like at a computer or something. So maybe you could say, but he doesn't need to bow in order to have a callus. But like, is one more better than the other or more useful?
No, I actually think they go together, but you have to see. I mean, you have to have the idea that monastic practice is supporting life in the same way that life is supporting the monastic practice.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. In the Bodhisattva monastic practice, yeah, it has to support all life. Yeah. So that's the question. And I think that's what Shakyamuni Buddha is saying to these monks. It's like, if you're getting supported like this, you better practice like a bodhisattva.
Yeah.
And what does that mean? Sometimes it might mean bowing and getting a callus on your forehead. And then you could say, how does that benefit beings? And you might say, it might benefit them just so that the question arises, why would somebody spend their time bowing that much when there's like fields to be plowed and there's stuff in this world that's like functional and useful to do? Why would somebody do such a useless thing? And we've talked about that some in this session, right?
Yeah.
Like Francis Cook said, to be able to do something like offering incense to an image of a Buddha that doesn't seem to like have any like function or result, it's so hard to do that because it doesn't seem to have any result, that to do something that's that hard, just to offer a stick of incense even, is like already arousing bodhicitta. I don't know about this, but you know, he said that. Yes.
It appears that they are spending a good part of their day doing prostrations around either at a stupa or going around a stupa, or I mean, this is a really profound practice for a lot of Tibetans and Nepalis. And I would definitely guess that some of them have calluses from they do thousands and thousands of these vows. So it's all part of this, you know. Okay, so zazen or building stupas, or, you know, what is the point of any of it?
Mm-hmm.
Is there a point to any of it?
Mm-hmm.
Or isn't there? You know, so I think it's just all part of the same discussion. Or just coming to the sashin, is there
a
point to
there
it?
There you go, right.
Are we making the world a better place?
We could be plowing the fields.
Right? Yeah. We could be poor or something like that. So I think it's just... What is it we're doing here?
Yeah.
When I have dry sits where I just feel like there's nothing going on, and then I'm just sort of daydreaming, and it's kind of like, okay, what am I doing here? So it's always kind of contemplating that, the core of that.
Yeah.
How is this making the world a better place for
sitting here. Yeah. And all these practices that seem like, I think one function of them in a kind of practical way is it just breaks down or challenges the rational mind. I feel in Asia even more so, because there's so many really poor people. A lot of those poor people are spending their days doing the prostrations. And then there's really elaborate monasteries and temples that must cost millions, and right, all together. And sometimes those temples are setting up huge hospitals and projects for poor people, and sometimes they're spending their time doing days and days of like elaborate ceremonies that seem to not be helping anyone, seem to. And that the beauty of that whole mix, and just like how if everything was just rational, functional, practical, it would miss something. I mean, to look at this huge scene and people doing all of these different things with feeling and devotion. Yeah.
That's the key.
So from this big perspective, it's like we can't make any distinction between these activities even. And I think it's more that paradox and that almost like forced breakdown of the rational mind, I think comes more over in Asia.